So this virtual night out is based on demystifying the pelvic floor. And I've actually got a huge amount to say. I don't know, I'm hoping I can get through it all in an hour, but we might have to maybe do a second sort of session if we need to on this, or I'll come back with any, you know, if you don't think of questions as I'm talking now, you know, you can email them to me and I can always address them after that. But actually, when I started pulling together all my notes and the workshops I've been on and stuff like that to bring this to you, I realized that probably this is going to answer, I hope, or bring more questions about a lot of the things we talk about, because you'll find that it's a bit more wide ranging maybe than just the pelvic floor. So, as I say, please ask me any questions, because it just makes it easier if I have a two-way sort of discussion. Otherwise, I think I sort of talked for an hour and I don't know if you're all still there or not. So first of all, I just want to pull up for you a diagram of the pelvic floor. And when to do this, what I do is I screen share with you. So you'll see in a minute that I'm going to bring up my... Has it come up yet? Let me just come off. So I'm hoping that you will now be able to see a picture of the pelvic floor. Can you all just unmute yourself and let me know that you can see that? Just so I know.
Yeah?
Good. We've got that there. Okay, so just... brilliant. Thank you. I'm sure that you know the pelvic floor, but I just thought we would just... I talk as if... we didn't, because then I can cover all bases. So this is a really nice diagram of the pelvic floor, I think. And looking at the pelvic floor here, what we have are a sort of basin. The pelvic floor, let me start again, sorry. The pelvic floor is about the size of your hand, okay? That's sort of like the sort of size that it is. And it's made up really of two groups of muscles, and it's the levator ani and the coccygeus. Now, I should say at the outset that what I call things out loud are simply what I see in my head, so I might not pronounce them correctly, so I do apologise. But you can see from the picture, we've got two muscle groups. We've got the levator ani and the coccygeus, okay? So you can see the coccygeus there comes across and inserts into the coccyx. And then the levator ani is made up of two muscles, really, the iliococcygeus and the pubococcygeus. And you can see that the pubococcygeus there runs from, it's really easy to know, it runs from the pubic bone to the coccyx. The iliococcygeus runs from the ilium to the coccyx. So really nice, easy words to remember if you want to. But I want you to just look at how they've got long fibres and they run along... that sort of midline of the pelvic floor. So you've almost got two sides, okay, that sort of connect down that midline. We then have the sphincters. So we've got the urethra, okay, there at the front near the pubic bone. And then we've got the anal sphincter, okay. And I'll come on to actually their purpose in a moment. And then in between the two, this is obviously a female pelvis, we've got the vaginal wall. So thinking about the function of these muscles and these areas, we've got the pelvic floor muscles, which act as that sort of dome, okay? And I'm going to talk more about whether it goes up, whether it goes down, what it does in detail. And we've got the two sphincters, and then we've got the vaginal wall. So what we have with the sphincters is they relax, obviously, to allow you to go to the toilet. Okay, nice and simple. And we've got the vaginal wall, which is a tubular muscle, okay, that sort of squeezes. And I just want you to look as well, as we're seeing this, just look and notice where the piriformis is there, okay, on each side, how close those muscles are and connected to the pelvic floor. Okay, so hopefully that has given you a really nice visual of the pelvic floor area, okay, and obviously it's a view from the top looking down. So You've got that on your mind, which is great. So I'm going to bring you back now to me. Okay. So first of all, what I want you to just interact with me a little bit is how do we move? Okay, so when one of the main questions that I think comes up is, you know, how do we engage the pelvic floor? Do we need to engage the pelvic floor? What should you say? What should happen when you engage the pelvic floor? And all those questions are hopefully what I'm going to answer this evening. So first of all, just tell me, how do we move? Okay, as a human being, how do I move? Just any words that spring to mind when you think of the movement that we do in a daily basis. Anybody want to jump in?
It's usually a complex combination of muscles, ligaments, nerves, not just one muscle group.
Yeah, brilliant, Laura. Brilliant. Anything else? Anybody else want to say anything else? Okay. This, where I'm going with this is to help sort of like look at the wider picture. Thinking about what you've done today, and I mean outside of your teaching, okay, just everyday tasks that you've done today, did you think about engaging the pelvic floor at any point? Did you consciously say to yourself, I'm just going to put my shoes on. Need to just pick up my pelvic floor.
No.
Did you need to when you did that? When you went to tie your shoes, was there any issue because you weren't picking up your pelvic floor?
No.
Why not? If we're worried about telling people about engaging their pelvic floor, why do we need to say it? If in my everyday activities, I don't even think about it, do I? You know, if I just say to you, okay, just stand up for me, you don't think, whoop, engage my pelvic floor because I'm about to stand up. Okay, you'll know where I'm going with this in a moment. So what I'm trying to say is that our normal movement, the movements we do every day, are natural and spontaneous, okay? Organization of our bodies. And there's key words that I want us to really highlight. It's natural, okay? It's spontaneous. We don't think about it. If you think about animals, the way they move, you don't see a cat or a dog going, whoa, lift my pelvic floor because I'm just about to do something. They just move naturally. And it almost goes back to, you know, how do we get to that state where we are moving naturally? Okay, where we don't have to think about engaging this and engaging that. And if you think, so for example, if you think about learning to walk, okay, if you think about a horse, okay, within the day of birth, that foal is walking, okay, very, very quickly, a foal will stand up, okay. Whereas, how long does it normally take a human to start walking? Yeah, a year, 18 months. And that time is really important. We shouldn't ever rush ourselves, getting our children walking, because that whole crawling, lifting is a very, very good process. We are learning what we need to do in order to be able to move. But nobody's telling us to switch this on or engage this, okay? We learn to do it. And it's how we learn to do it that I really want to get into tonight. So first of all, what I'm saying is that our normal movement, our natural movement, our natural organization of all our systems, all our parts, is spontaneous, it's subconscious, and it's sub-threshold, okay? So for me, just to stand up, I don't think about it. It happens spontaneously, subconsciously, and sub-threshold. So what I mean by spontaneous is that I don't have to think what to do to stand up. I just do it. I don't have to think I have got to switch this on, get this aligned, do this. I just do it without thinking. It's subconscious in that I'm not aware of the systems I use to stand up. Okay, when I just take off my Pilates head and just stand up, I'm not aware of all the things that happen in order to get me standing up. And finally, it's sub-threshold, and this is really important. I only use whatever I need to use to perform the task, nothing more. So a tiny amount of effort should go into me standing up, okay? You're probably thinking, why is this about the pelvic floor? But this is what I mean about this picture being so much wider than just the pelvic floor, okay? It's hopefully going to answer a lot of questions. So those three words I really, really want you to keep hold of: spontaneous, subconscious, and sub-threshold. That is the ideal, the happiest, the healthiest form of movement I can have. And with our clients, that is what we're looking to help them get to, okay? We want to help them find their way to that movement, to that style of movement, where it's spontaneous, subconscious, and sub-threshold. So what I want to go back to is, how do we learn what to use? So if you think, as a baby, I have 18 months to learn to walk, because the walking for a human is so complex, okay? We've gone from four legs to two legs. It's so complex. So how do we learn what to use, how to use it, what happens, okay? Anybody know? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Just so I know you're still with me. Anything? Don't worry if you're not. I'll only give you a few more seconds, then I'll answer myself. It's anticipation, okay? We anticipate what's going to happen when we do a task. And that anticipation is based on experience, okay? So what I want you to think about is newly walking child, baby, trying to pick something up off the floor, okay? The first time they try and pick something up, they will generally fall on their face. It hurts, they cry. The next time they go to pick something up, they'll start learning, oh, if I do it that way, I'm gonna land on my face. So this time, I'm gonna lean back, and they fall back and they land on their bum, bit of a softer landing, much happier. So at the beginning, they start to learn, and we start to anticipate what we need to do the activity we are doing, okay? We've got to be doing the activity in order to be able to learn and begin and practice and begin to anticipate what I need to use to do that activity. And with a new experience, generally we will over recruit. We will try too hard, but over time it gets less and less and less. So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, right, what have I done over the past, you know, that I, in my adult life, that I can see this in. And one of them is learning to play tennis. Now I remember when I first started to learn to play tennis, you completely try and hoof the ball over. You use so much to get that forehand drive going. And then gradually over time, you realize I don't need to use this much, okay? Different areas of my body are gonna come into it. Different things are gonna fire through. My wrist action, everything is gonna just start to come in, and I'm gonna have to use less and less effort. Another one is, think about those of you that know how to ski. If you learn to ski as an adult, you'll remember you're stiff, you're really, really trying to sort of almost just bulldoze your way down the slope, and then gradually you realize I don't need to put so much effort into those turns if I can just slightly change my center of gravity or that little press, I'll get around there. So what we begin to do is, anticipation is what we need, and it's anticipation, and I'm going to talk more about this, anticipation of the necessary load to do the task that we're going to do. Okay, and that's something that is really important. We learn to know that if I'm going to pick up my pen, I anticipate how much this pen weighs, because I've done it so many times. I've picked up a pen so many times, I know how much it's going to weigh. Okay, and something that I always think is really interesting is when you go to pick up a box that you think is full, but it's actually empty. And it really goes, oh, suddenly, because you've anticipated it, you're going to have to lift it and it's going to be quite heavy and your body's ready for that. But what it ends up is light, and it throws you. You're like, oh my goodness. And you almost stumble back because you've already anticipated how you're going to react to gravity to lift that box. And because it's lighter than you think, you actually overbalance because there's been that change there. So I will come back to this, okay? It's going to be a recurrent theme, anticipation. Any questions so far? Because I've sort of just glossed over quite a big section there, but I am aware that we are going to talk about, we're here for the pelvic floor. No, we're all good? Okay. So let's bear those thoughts in mind, just have them in the background. And what I want to talk about now, I want to go into about the relationship between the abdominal wall, the diaphragm, and the pelvic floor, okay? Because this really is where, as Pilates instructors, you know, we know, we were told years ago there was a relationship, there is a relationship, but it's how that relationship interacts, how those three parts interact, that is so important. And I've simplified this to sort of make it just the abdominal wall, the diaphragm, and the pelvic floor. Okay, there is a bit more to that, but I'm just going to strip it back a little bit. The most important thing that you can consider and that you can think about when you're teaching is intra-abdominal pressure. Okay, it is so much more important than thinking about whether a muscle activates in what way, in this way or that way. So intra-abdominal pressure is what causes the control of movement for the spine. Okay, I'm going to try not to say stability too much because I think stability sometimes has that connotation of rigidity. And what I want to think of instead of stability, I'm going to try and change it tonight to be more about control of mobility. Okay, so intra-abdominal pressure is all about what gives that control of movement, that control of mobility for the spine. Okay, so I'm going to share you another picture now that I'm going to just talk about. So let me just flick through all this. And this is something you'll have seen a lot. Okay, so can you all see that now? I hope so. So this is something that obviously we use, was used to sort of highlight the core. It's the only night I'm going to say that word, but the core. But it's actually much more than that. I've stripped it back. It's known as the hydraulic amplifier, okay? And it actually includes thoracolumbar fascia. It includes much more of the musculature around the torso. But I sort of stripped it back tonight for us just to zone in on the pelvic floor. So you can sort of see the diaphragm at the top here, the abdominal wall around the outside, and the pelvic floor. So what you, as I sort of said there, you can see the diaphragm at the top, the abdominal wall wrapping around, and the pelvic floor. And I'm going to take you off that for a moment. Just to, hopefully I've now come back, good. Okay, so what you have there with that hydraulic amplifier, okay, is it's showing you the relationship between the abdominal wall, the pelvic floor, and the diaphragm. Okay, now I hope you can see me. Okay, so I've got a mini ball here. And I want you to imagine that this is like that hydraulic amplifier, okay? So if I contract the abdominal wall, okay, I'm gonna push that way. And I hope you can see that the diaphragm at the top has pushed up and the pelvic floor at the bottom, okay, has got pressure going down. So intra-abdominal pressure is like this, okay? It's inside this ball here. If I contract my abdominal wall, okay, to increase intra-abdominal pressure, it's going to push upwards on the diaphragm and downwards on the pelvic floor, Okay, so that's what intra-abdominal pressure does. It helps us to give that control, that stiffness to the spine for the movement that I'm going to do. Okay, so I can track my abdominals and I get that. Imagine then if I then push down on the diaphragm, if I inhale with the diaphragm, okay, I get pressure outwards into the abdominal wall and downwards onto the pelvic floor. Yeah, you're all still with me. If I push upwards with the pelvic floor, I get pressure outwards into the abdominals and pressure upwards into the diaphragm. Yeah? So changes in intra-abdominal pressure are what helps my spine to stiffen for the job that I'm going to do. Is everybody with me on that? Just tell me a yet or text me a yet.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. And am I being too simple here?
No.
Okay.
It's
so,
good to recap.
Yeah, exactly. So
you're listening, you're fine.
Yeah. So what I want to show you here is I am gonna talk about core research because I think it's necessary, because this is really where, as Pilates instructors, we started talking about the pelvic floor. It came from the research, you know, about the core, and that's why suddenly we were engaging the pelvic floor to do our movement. So, but this is what happens. This is what the body does. When I move, when I do anything, when I go to pick something up, I increase intra-abdominal pressure in order to stiffen and create the necessary tension for the anticipated load of what I'm going to do. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, so that's what intra-abdominal pressure is. So if we practice doing an activity that we want to do, that we need to do, our body will begin to know what we're going to need to successfully do that activity. Yeah? Something that I really want you to take away with you today as well is that we are built to learn how to do something. We're not built to just do it. Okay? That's why it takes us so long to walk. We learn to do it through lots of complex movements and, do you know what I mean, just rolling, lifting the head. There's a procedure that we go through to do it. We don't just naturally should be able to do it. We've got to do something in order for the body to learn the anticipated load needed, the tension needed for the anticipated load of the activity we're going to do. Is that okay? So this all happens in a moment. I'm going to show you how very, very spontaneously, sub-threshold and subconsciously. These shifts, these changes in intra-abdominal pressure, the movement, the relationship between the pelvic floor, the abdominal wall and the diaphragm happens to help increase or decrease intra-abdominal pressure for the activity I'm about to do. So coming on to thinking about actually voluntary contracting the pelvic floor or consciously contracting muscles to do a job. So what I want you to think of, again, not in your classes, in everyday things you've done, brushing your teeth, making the dinner, making the bed, walking, whatever you've done today, is there anything you have done where you have consciously activated a muscle? Anything? I'm thinking no. I should imagine no. Okay. You haven't, to do your everyday activities, there is nothing that you have had to do consciously. You've not had to think, I need to switch this on because I'm about to do this. So why did we start doing it in our Pilates sessions? Because it didn't come from Joe Pilates. And I think we sort of know that The main area that it came from was from the research developed by Richardson Hodges and Dull and their team. Okay, that's really one of the main things that sort of has been sourced. And what I want to do is simplify what their findings were so that you can really have a very clear picture. What they did, okay, was they found, Hodges found, that when you lift up the arm, okay, when you lift your arm up above your head, the transverse abdominis responded 50 milliseconds prior to the deltoid. Okay, so in lifting up my arm, my transverse abdominis responded 50 milliseconds prior to my deltoid. Okay, that's what they found. And this was consistent over a range of participants. So what they then did was they tested it on patients with low back pain. And they found that that reaction time, that response time, was not consistent at all. It was all over the place in low back pain. Okay. So this led to the assumption that if we trained in an isolated contraction, the transverse abdominis, it would decrease low back pain. Yeah? Do you think it would? And I want you to answer me on this one. And tell me if you think that isolating muscles in order to create a better response time is what's going to happen. Everybody want to give it a go? Who's going to be brave enough?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Catherine.
I'm just going to say no.
Yeah.
It must work in isolation.
Yeah, good. That's one point. Nothing works in isolation. Any other reason?
Play devil's advocate to that.
Yeah.
I suppose the question is there any benefits to over reactivating, trying to, if there's been an injury or if there's been a reason that things aren't responding, the anticipation isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
How do you get it back? Is it just through muscle memory and practicing over and over again and it comes back? I suppose that's the question in my mind at the minute. Or can you retrain to get the anticipation back? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Now, first of all, Eli Lederman answered that question about that lack of response time. And one of his reasons that it could be is because when an area is damaged, you don't contract it. You know, you get the inflammation in order to allow the area to, you know, you get that sort of lack of movement in order for the area to heal. So one of his arguments against this was the fact that actually when you have low back pain, maybe the muscles haven't got that response because they don't want it, because they don't want the area to respond yet because it's healing. Does that make sense?
No.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. But I know where you're going with that, Laura, and we are going to come back to that. Okay. Yeah. How quick did the transversus... How quick was the transversus response?
Sorry,
50 milliseconds. How quick is that? Ridiculously quick. Okay, if I perform a voluntary contraction such as winking, okay, it takes 250 milliseconds for me to think I'm going to wink, my brain to do it, and me to physically do it, a voluntary contraction. A voluntary contraction will take at least a quarter of a second. So imagine if that transversus response of 50 milliseconds prior to lifting up the arm, if I have to consciously think, I'm gonna do a move, I'm gonna switch on, it takes me a quarter of a second. So it's far too slow, okay? Far too slow. What I'm gonna just talk about this bit because I think it might be a bit easier. But what makes me reacts to an anticipated movement is my proprioception. Okay, my proprioceptive system. And the proprioceptive system working at the spinal cord level. Okay, so when there's a thought that there's going to be an anticipated load, it sends a signal which kicks in the necessary response at a subconscious, spontaneous, and sub-threshold level. And I cannot do that through my thoughts. Okay, does that make sense? The nervous system is so much smarter, so much quicker than I am. Okay, and so thinking about, I mean, I'm not saying that teaching somebody to feel their pelvic floor, to what does it feel like, to switch it on, to work it, to use those cues, it may still have a place, okay, to get that person to feel whether it's working or not, you know. But in reality, in functional movement, it's not how our bodies work. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So the thing is that we've sort of got caught in this trap from this false assumption that in order to make a muscle work again, we need to isolate it. We need to overwork it, because that's what we do. When we consciously think, and I'll do another little thing with you in a minute, of something doing the work, we will overwork, okay? So let's do it now, actually. Okay, I want you to all stand up for me. Okay, so if you just stand up, I can't see you, so I'm just going to hope you're all standing up now. And then what I want you to do is just feel the front of your thighs, okay, as you're standing there. And hopefully you're feeling smallest bit of work, okay, because we have to use the legs to stand up. But you can feel there's hardly any work going on. I don't have to overwork because my body knows to stand up, this is all I need to do. Okay, so now what I want you to do is stand on one leg. Okay, so just lift the one leg up. And I want you to feel that leg again. And can you feel that it's working that little bit harder, but not noticeably harder? Okay. And then what I want you to do is I want you to now really squeeze your legs tightly. Okay, lock them back and squeeze them. And feel... think about switching on the front of your legs, and you will generally now feel how much more you're working. That's far too much work for the everyday activity of standing up. It's exhausting and it's just plain wrong. Does that make sense? Yeah?
I've sat down now.
Yeah, because you're knackered. But that's what we do when we voluntarily, when we consciously switch on a muscle. I mean, what you could try and do if you want is stand up again and feel the muscle tone. Feel how you've got that really low sub-threshold work going on in the legs. And then try and think about contracting the legs and try and get yourself back to that same minimal level of work that you were doing without thought. And I'm guessing you won't be able to do it, because our bodies are so clever. They know the amount of work I need to do to stand up should be minimal. And the fact is that the better I get at standing up, the better my alignment, the less work I am going to have. Your body wants to be as efficient as it possibly can. And that is what we teach it to be, I hope, in Pilates. That's what I want you to take from today. That we are looking to try and get people to move and live and do everything as efficiently as possible. We don't want people to get strong muscles. We want them to get efficient muscles so they do exactly what they need to do. If you slouched and stood there, your legs would start to feel knackered because they're not being held in the most efficient place. Okay. Let me do another one with you. Okay. I want you to sit there. I don't know if you can see me. And I want you to just Bring your elbows to the sides of your waist. Turn your palms up to the ceiling. Let me just see if you can see me here. So I'm like that. Okay. And then all I want you to do is just loosely twist. Okay. Side to side. Just twist for me. Okay. Really loosely. Think about lifting up tall. So think about sitting just nice and as lifted and as light as you can. Okay. And just gently twist. Nice and easy. Okay, I hope you're all doing this. Now what I want you to do is imagine you've got a can of beans in each hand. So you're holding just a can of beans in each hand. And then I want you to let go of those can of beans and just imagine there's nothing in your hands again. And then I want you to imagine you're holding a bottle of wine in each hand. Let's go for it, it's a Friday night. So imagine you're holding a bottle of wine in each hand. And then put the bottle of wine down. And just go back to your normal twisting there. Okay, stop there. Tell me what happened. Anybody?
Well, I naturally felt that I was making more effort.
Yeah, so what happened, Mary, when I said to you, you had a bottle of wine in each hand? What happened to your movement?
It became harder.
Good. Became harder. In what way? Did you find that you were using more muscles?
I was anticipating. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
I was anticipating.
Yes. Perfect. What else did you notice? Anybody else? As well as you, Mary. Did anybody slow down a little bit?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Perfect. I had less movement, but as soon as you told me to let it go, I was flinging like an idiot.
Yeah. Brilliant.
I was standing, by the way, because I'm washing up.
Brilliant.
All over the place, so yeah, that was
awesome. Okay, excellent. So exactly, more concentration from wrong. So what you had was your nervous system took over. It anticipated, because you know how it feels to hold a can of beans. You know how it feels maybe to hold a bottle of wine. So therefore your body went, I more or less know how much a bottle of wine weighs. I more or less know how much a can of bean weighs. So I'm going to anticipate, I need a little bit more stiffness. I need just to slow down a little bit. And you almost felt, I think, a little bit heavier. Okay. And then as soon as you let it go, you went back to that very light rotating again. That is your nervous system. And I wanted to show you that it's so much smarter than we are. Now let's do it again. Okay, so think about that sense of lightness through your spine again. Imagine you've got the palms up again and just give me that twist again. Okay, so that gentle twisting round. And then what I'd like you to do is as you're twisting, you're going to consciously switch on your abdominal wall to control the movement. And then let it go. And as we're talking about this, as you're twisting, I now want you to lift up the pelvic floor. And let it go. Right, how did that feel? Anybody?
Yeah, the same. It was slower. Slowed down. It was more laboured. I was...
Good. Okay. Did it feel more laboured, Mary?
It felt...
Stiff. Brilliant, Laura. Brilliant. So as Laura said, sorry, Mary, it felt stiff. If you carried on doing that, the potential for you to start feeling a bit, oh, this is feeling horrible. Don't like this. Because you're working too hard for what your body needs to do. So it makes you rigid. It creates a rigidity because it's an over-recruitment. It's not the natural process. You've stopped the nervous system from doing what it does so well, okay? I know some of you are thinking, but those people with pelvic floor issues, we're going to come to that, okay? So don't worry about that. So if we have... So what we need to do is let the nervous system do its job. Okay, Don't try and obstruct it by making this voluntary contraction happen, okay? You need to create an environment where the nervous system learns, anticipates, practices, and therefore has an incredibly high chance of doing a much better job than my conscious brain can. Okay, how am I doing for time? Oh, I've got so much to say still. Okay, right, so what we've done there is we've just looked, first of all, at the spontaneous versus the voluntary, okay, contraction and control. What I now want you to look at is the mechanical relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor. Okay, so I'm going to show you a video now. Now this, my go-to person for a lot of the stuff I do, and you know, a lot of this stuff came from a workshop I did with Brent Anderson. He's an amazing guy. He owns Polestar and he's just amazing. And the research I'm going to talk about is actually what they have ongoing at the moment. But I want to show you a video, and I have shared this video on the forum before, but I'm going to bring it up for you again, just because it is, oh, has that gone in? So I'm hoping you can all see my stuff. Uh-huh. So I'm hoping you can see, the video of YouTube here. Okay, and I'm gonna start it just a minute in. So what he did in 2015, this is when they really began looking much more into the pelvic floor and what actually happens. And this was in 2015, the PMA, and you can get this on YouTube and I will send you a link to it. And what they're doing is they're showing the relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor, okay? And I want to show you what happens when we breathe. Okay, so you're gonna hear Brent's voice now, but what they did is they've got two ultrasounds on this Pilates instructor. They've got an ultrasound on her diaphragm, which is in the top picture there, and an ultrasound on her pelvic floor. And just before we go into it, just look, I hope you can see where the diaphragm is. If I put my arrow there, you should see it, okay? It's that dome there. And then, as we look down, this is the pelvic floor here. Okay, so I hope you can see where I've got my little cursor arrow. So I'm gonna now let Brent explain.
That as she breathes in, the pelvic floor drops down and the diaphragm drops down. As she exhales, we see the diaphragm rising up and we see the pelvic floor rising up. So we see this real beautiful relationship that we've hypothesized, but it's nice now that we actually are capturing the information with two ultrasounds to be able to do that.
Okay, so what I want to say here is how often when we think about the pelvic floor, we just think we've got to draw it up, okay? We think that when we activate, when we engage, the pelvic floor draws up. But the natural, spontaneous, I'm going to be saying these words over and over, movement of the pelvic floor is its relationship with the diaphragm. As we inhale and the diaphragm goes down, the pelvic floor also goes down. As the diaphragm goes up, as we exhale, the pelvic floor also goes up. Okay? And so if I restrict my breathing, if I don't allow my diaphragm that lovely, natural inning and up, okay, it will cause too much stiffness. It will cause too much intra-abdominal pressure, okay? And it has the potential of causing pelvic floor dysfunction. So again, to show you this. So if I think about restricting my diaphragmatic movement, so I want you to really draw your abdominal wall in, draw your stomach in, and try and breathe, okay? Can you feel that you've really increased the intra-abdominal pressure and you've created far too much stiffness in the spine? It will also lead to that lack of relationship between the pelvic floor and the diaphragm, which is critical, okay? And I'm wondering whether to say this now, but I will do so. An example of this, and I'll talk about it more another time, is people doing the roll-up. So for my roll-up, what I want is that beautiful intra-abdominal pressure working as I get beautiful segmental control up through the spine. But what do most people do when they do a roll-up is they go and they hold their breath. And therefore, there's a big increase in intra-abdominal pressure, a huge amount of stiffness in the spine, and I have no articulation, okay? So it's the same if I lift my pelvic floor, okay, and engage my pelvic floor, it's going to restrict the movement of my diaphragm. It's going to over-increase intra-abdominal pressure for the move I need to do, and therefore create too much stiffness and no segmental control. Any questions on what I've said there? What I'm hoping you're thinking about is, aha, should the pelvic floor always go up? Should it go down? Does it matter what it does? Is where I'm thinking I want you to be going with your thoughts. Okay, so again, as I said, Polestar is, Brent Anderson at Polestar is the place at the moment that I go to for, they started off doing this fantastic case study. They're now developing it into much more of a paper, and I know they're still gathering a lot of data in order to produce something on this. But what I want to go to now is that often when we say to people, engage your pelvic floor, okay, I want us to think, are they doing or are we doing what we think we're doing? So when I engage my pelvic floor, what should happen? I'm going to ask you, what should happen when I engage my pelvic floor? Anybody?
Would it be the diaphragm going up?
Okay, the diaphragm goes up. What happens to the pelvic floor?
I'm going to draw the pelvic
floor.
It goes up. Uh-huh. Does the pelvic floor go up when I engage it?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay. I'm going to get you to hold that thought. So what Brent did is over a couple of years since 2015, mainly 2016, they at the conferences, so different places all around the world, they have brought ultrasound machines and they got 200, okay, so far, Pilates instructors averaging 5 years of experience. So you're talking about Pilates instructors who have taught for an average of 5 years. So we're talking experienced, knowledgeable Pilates instructors. And they got them to lie on their backs and using an ultrasound machine, ask them to activate their pelvic floor, to engage their pelvic floor, to draw up their pelvic floor. And what do you think happened? Out of 200 Pilates instructors, how many do you think, what percentage do you think drew up their pelvic floor? Most of them?
Well, I'd say yes.
Okay.
But
from my tone of voice. No, 45% of them were pushing down. Okay, so I can't send you these images because obviously they're not owned by me, and you know, obviously they're not mine to hand out. So what I want to show you is what they found. So first of all, this is an instructor who was asked to engage her pelvic floor, and she did. So can you see where my little arrow is here? Can you all see that?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. So this is her pelvic floor here, where my little sort of cross is. And you can see that when she was asked to engage, there it goes. So this is her stomach. This is the base of her pelvis. And this is her pelvic floor. And you can see she did well. Yeah? We can see that on... Oh, by the way, the black area is a bladder. Okay, and obviously for ultrasound, you generally want it full of urine, so you get this darkness, so you can see. So you can see here, here's her at rest, and here is her activating the pelvic floor, and it's pressing upwards into her bladder. Great. Okay. The next one, let's have a look at this one. This one is another one. Okay, now this one, let me get rid of that one, is where, here's her pelvic floor here, is where she lifts her pelvic floor, but what you also see is the abdominal wall really kicking in as well. Okay, and you can see there, pelvic floor, doming upwards of the pelvic floor. Brilliant. Okay, this one is what 45% did. They thought they were drawing up, but can you see there's a definite pushing down? And we got that. So even though highly experienced Pilates instructors felt that they were drawing up, they were actually pushing down with their pelvic floor. Now, again, I want you to hold the thought. I'm not saying this is bad. Okay, I'm not saying you need to draw up, draw down, whatever. I'm just saying, notice what the sensation of drawing up, they were actually pushing down. Okay, and then finally, just this one to show you. What we see here, can you see this is at rest, but can you see here on the picture, these two here, that's them actually using their glutes to do it. Okay, so we get a little bit of pelvic floor activation, but look at the amount of glute work that comes in to squeeze the bladder. Okay, so my point here is that even when we think we are activating the pelvic floor, potentially we're not, as in we're not drawing up. 45% we're pushing down, okay? So, is it important that the pelvic floor goes up or down? Now, first of all, you know that when we're breathing, to have the right amount of desirable intra-abdominal pressure for the job I need to do, there needs to be a relationship between the diaphragm descending and the pelvic floor descending, okay? So therefore, it's not whether or not it matters whether it's going up or down. It matters whether you get the appropriate amount of tension in the pelvic floor for the anticipated load. Okay? But from our point of view, what I want to come back to a little bit is when we're telling our clients to activate their pelvic floor, we have no idea what they are doing. Because first of all, we can't see it. Okay, we can't see what's happening down there, so we don't know. Generally, they're lying on their backs doing it, so their vestibular system, the inner ear, is not either helping them to know what's going on there. Okay, and finally, the proprioception of what's happening also might not be happening there. They might have a sense that they're lifting, but they're not. So how do we know that what we're doing is the right thing anyway? But the more important question is, do we actually need to? Because is that getting somebody to voluntarily contract their pelvic floor what we want them to do in order to move spontaneously, subconsciously, subthreshold? Okay. Right. So, second piece of research, and I can send you this. Okay, so I can send you the paper. It was done, again, it was actually done by one of the Polestar faculty and her partner. So it's by Danielle Holder and her partner's called Tanner. So I can actually send you the link to this paper. And what they were looking at is whether Pilates exercises cause pelvic floor harm. Okay, if whether that increase in what the increase in intra-abdominal pressure is to do your Pilates exercises and how that affects the pelvic floor. So what they did was Tanner invented this intra-vaginal intra-abdominal pressure measuring device. Okay, so they then set a gold standard. So what they did is they measured the intra-abdominal pressure through this intravaginal device going from seated to standing. So they got people from seated to stand up. And they measured the amount of intra-abdominal pressure needed to that for that to happen. And then what they did was they then took mat work and reformer exercises, the beginner and intermediate exercises, as set out on Rael Yusevich's book. I can never say his surname properly. And they put their clients, their bodies, through the intermediate and beginner mat and reformer exercises. And again, I'm going to get you to have a little guess. How many exercises do you think it had a higher intra-abdominal increase in intra-abdominal pressure than just going from seated to standing? Just throw me a number. From the beginner and intermediate repertoire. So 75% from Laura. It's like guessing marbles in a jar. Anything?
Far less.
If I told you one exercise.
it's a lot more effort.
Yeah, so only one. Yeah, so it was only the roll-up series in mat and reformer that had, and it was only a smidge of the intra-abdominal pressure that you get from seated to standing. So if you do, so what I'm saying is that doing Pilates does not cause any harm to the pelvic floor, as in does not, do you know what I mean? There was only one exercise that had created more intra-abdominal pressure than the simple thing of going from seated to standing, okay? So, in Pilates, is there any time that you actually need to engage the pelvic floor? No.
Probably not.
No. No. You do not need that voluntary over-recruitment of the pelvic floor in Pilates. What it does is it will inhibit the segmental control and that body's beautiful ability to move. Thinking about pelvic floor dysfunction, okay, and I'm going to touch on it a little bit more in a moment. If the diaphragm's restricted, so what I'm sort of trying to get you to see is when there's pelvic floor dysfunction, teaching somebody to engage their pelvic floor might not be the way to go, okay? Think you've seen in that video of how the relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor is just so natural and so crucial for good movement. If the diaphragm is restricted, there's a likelihood that there it will cause pelvic floor dysfunction. Because if I've got a lack of thoracic mobility, which means that my rib cage isn't moving as freely as it should, which means therefore my diaphragm is not descending, okay, as fluidly as it should, it's going to have the potential to affect the pelvic floor function. So if this is a much wholer picture than just thinking, oh, I'll just get them to just engage, strengthen their pelvic floor by thinking of it. It's not going to work functionally. So sometimes the immobility of the thoracic spine creates the pelvic floor. And when does our thoracic spine get immobile? What do we do too much that creates this thoracic immobility? We sit. Exactly. We sit. Okay, so this is almost trying to go a bit deeper than just, you know, it's because we sit all day because there's no gravity playing on the pelvic floor. Yes, that's there. But it's also the lack of thoracic mobility, that that sense of living in fight or flight where we're not allowing the diaphragm to drop and release fully because we're shallow breathing, okay? All of that is going to affect the pelvic floor. That we're over-contracting the abdominal wall, it's going to affect the pelvic floor function because it affects the diaphragmatic movement. So, taking those few bits of Daniel Holder's research and what Brent Anderson was doing with the ultrasound. They then took the same 200 instructors where 45% were not engaging in a positive way, as in they were pushing down when they thought they were pulling up. Okay, they then took those 200 instructors and they ultrasounded them again without getting them to engage to have a look if their diaphragm and their pelvic floor had the correct relationship. Okay, so out of those 200 instructors that they first of all looked at lying down on their back, getting them to voluntary contract, they then looked to see if mechanically the relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor was working. Okay, 90% of the instructors were fine. Okay, so they got a positive big tick. Okay, their pelvic floor was absolutely fine. The issue is when they tried to think about what they were doing. Okay, so mechanically, the relationship between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor was fine. They then, okay, with them, they then asked them to go from seated to standing to see what happened with the interplay with intra-abdominal pressure. And of the 45% that incorrectly activated the first time, now 69% did it correctly. So what you've now got, I had to work out the maths on this myself, but you've got, out of that 200 instructors, only 5% voluntarily contracted incorrectly. Mechanically, it didn't work the same. So they almost got two negatives, okay? And sit to stand, it didn't, the relationship wasn't correct. And those 5% had dysfunction of the diaphragm, the movement of the diaphragm, and incontinence issues. What they then did is they then manually released, because obviously they're all physios, manually released the diaphragm on those 5%, on those five. And with two of them, the diaphragm sprung back into normal activation, into normal movement pattern. So it was only two people, okay, who were left and they obviously had the pelvic floor dysfunction, obviously needed to seek, if they wanted to, further help. So that is phenomenal, okay, that what they did is that they found out that so many people couldn't voluntarily correctly, as they thought, lift the pelvic floor. They then went on to see if mechanically the relationship was fine. 90% were fine. They then released the diaphragm and there was only then, you know, the three people out of 200 instructors that were left that still had that pelvic floor dysfunction in their movement. So that's amazing. Okay, the areas that potentially we should go to in order to help our clients. Okay, is that making sense? Now, Polestar are doing, and this sort of like was going on in 2016, so there's been a little longer, but I do know they're looking at doing much more research. They're looking at collating much more data on this. So hopefully, in a few years, we'll get a little bit more of, you know, concrete evidence. But I think that is just mind-blowing. So thinking about what we do, okay, and the issues that we see, and again, we'll see how far we can get with this. But what I want you to think about, I'm going to take you back to that first picture I showed you. So if we just hold on, let me go back to my pelvis. So the majority of pelvic floor issues that we see, I think you'd agree, is often after childbirth. And it's generally incontinence of the urethra sphincter, yeah? And that is more often the issue. Sorry, I'm going around the wrong place there. That's more often the issue we see, isn't it? That people say, you know, oh, I wet myself, I sneezed, or we see, you know, further issues than that. It's generally that we have the incontinence of the urethra sphincter. What often we see, because the other question I want you to ask yourself is, often this pubococcygeus muscle here, particularly, is often hypertonic rather than being too loose. So I think often in our heads we think, the pelvic floor's weak. It's not lifting enough. It's not strong enough to lift. On a lot of people, it's actually hypertonic. And I want to take you back just quickly into some of the photos of this ultrasound that we've seen. Can you see in this one, the pelvic floor is always already lifted. This is hypertonic. So they don't need to lift more. Okay, look at this one here. There, you can see it's not already doming. Okay, so there we get the lift. Here, I'm already lifted. Can you see that? This one here, you can see that definite flat line. This one here, look at that, already doming there. So it's hypertonic. So for those clients, they don't need to tighten more, okay? They need to get the correct amount of tension to do the anticipated load. Now, we can't tell, looking at our clients, can we? If, let me come back. We can't tell, looking at our clients, if they're hypertonic or if they're too loose. You can tell on an ultrasound, maybe Catherine, you can tell with some physical palpitation, but I'm not going to go and have a quick feel of anybody. It's way outside my thing. So what we say to people to get them to engage the pelvic floor could actually, don't think it'd ever harm anybody, but it's not going to do the good that we think it's going to do. So what I hope that I'm getting across to you is that voluntary contractions of muscles creates rigidity, creates stiffness, creates a false movement, okay? If we get the alignment right, if we practice and anticipate correctly the daily task that we want to do, and if our goal is movement efficiency and body efficiency, then there's an incredibly high chance that our neuromuscular system is going to be successful. Much cleverer, much quicker, much smarter than I ever will be, my conscious brain, okay? So, yes. So, any questions on what I've just said? Any thoughts? That's one thing I want. So, go on, Mary.
No, I'm just really interested in the diaphragm and the pelvic floor.
Yeah.
So I'm getting a feedback on this. I can hear myself.
Don't worry. It sounds okay here, Mary.
Okay. So I happened to have a treatment the other day, and my diaphragm is very restricted. Obviously, the guy who was treating me wasn't checking me for pelvic floor or anything. I just had some pain in my thoracic and coming around the ribcage. And he just immediately went to my diaphragm and just said, it's too tight. It's just in a constant state of tightness. So I'm wondering, if that's going on there, what's happening lower down?
I mean,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because when I'm talking to my clients, I'm drawing into, I think I'm pulling up my pelvic floor while I'm actually saying it.
But the thing is, why?
When I'm talking to you now.
Yeah. But why are you doing that? Why are you consciously doing it? Because you're sat in a chair. You don't need to be. Do you get what I mean, Mary? So maybe it's the opposite way. Maybe, I mean, and as I say, I don't know, Mary, because it's, you know, but just hypothesizing. Maybe because your pelvic floor, you're trying to lift it all the time, that's what's locking the diaphragm out, giving you your thoracic pain.
Yeah.
I mean, for example.
I'm really interested in this sort of relationship.
Yeah.
Because I don't tend to have many people who have a pelvic floor dysfunction, or not, certainly not that they're telling me. They're not coming to Marcy's for that. They're coming for that pain.
Brilliant. So hold that thought, Mary. Because how is their segmental control? This is where I meant that this chat is going to go wider than pelvic floor. And that's what as soon as I started pulling together what I was going to say, I was thinking, gosh, this is going to hit into different areas for different people. But look at the mobility. You know, if I'm restricted in my pelvic floor and I'm drawing up my pelvic floor, and it's restricting my diaphragm, the intra-abdominal pressure is too great. So I'm creating too much stiffness. So how am I going to be able to do a roll-up easy? I can't.
Yeah.
Because I can't segmentally move. I'm trying to lift up a chunk of myself. It's not going to happen. So that's the importance of, and this is where what we cue is so important. If we made things simpler, we would do everybody in the world a favor. Do you know what I mean? Instead of saying, cue this, pick up this, pull in this, do this. No, just breathe and just move and trust your nervous system. But the other thing that go ahead, Mary, sorry.
Just between pelvic curls and pelvic tilts.
Yeah.
Way overactivated.
Yes.
And I had it today with a guy, it's a rugby player. And he has just been used to doing lots of bridging, lifting his hips, trying to engage his, glutes, etc. I don't know why the gym was telling him to do that. Didn't have the time to go through it with him, but I was more interested in how he could control his lower back, which he had none of.
Exactly. And what's the cue that people use? Squeeze your glutes. Why do I need to do that? I don't need to do that because I'm then over-recruiting, which is going to stop the control, the mobility. It's a rigidity.
Yeah.
So therefore, I'm not going to get the opening at the front of my hip because my glutes are banging on, which is going to have an effect on the outer thigh, the inner thigh, the front of my thigh. I'm not going to go anywhere at all. So I think that as soon as I was writing this today, I knew we need to do more chats on this because it's really planting a few seeds, I think. And the other thing that I just wanted to say for a moment is, in order to get efficient at the activity, you need to do it. So when you've got somebody who comes to you and says they've got pelvic floor issues, first of all, there's a couple of things to think of. Ask them, what is it, when do you suffer mainly leaking? When does it happen? And if it happens when they sneeze, think about how often do I sneeze? I went for a run today and I was thinking, when was the last time I sneezed? And it was a long, long time ago. And I thought, might wet myself a bit here, I cross my legs. Because it's not as much an issue for that once every few times a year for me to worry about that massive increase in intra-abdominal pressure that after having three children, I may have a smidge of dysfunction in my urethral sphincter. Okay, so, but if it's somebody who says, I want to go running, what do they have to do to create the environment where their body learns to anticipate the necessary intra-abdominal pressure and load and work that needs to go on for them to run without constantly leaking? They need to do it. They need to run so their body can begin to practice and anticipate. And obviously there may be deeper issues. And those deeper issues are something we cannot, as Pilates instructors, deal with. It has to go higher. There's so much out there for people with incontinence issues that is not Pilates. Okay, what I hope I've tried to get across is voluntary engaging your pelvic floor does not necessarily help heal it. Okay, it doesn't work like that. Maybe getting them to breathe better does, and release the diaphragm. Maybe getting them to mobilize their thoracic does. Maybe creating the environment where their alignment is correct, their body begins to work efficiently, they practice, and their neuromuscular system kicks back in and gets everything in the right place. Yes. Sorry, that was my last little point that I nearly forgot to mention. And it's whether or not that person is willing to put the time and effort and often money in to do that, or are they quite happy just to carry on and, you know, pop in a tenner lady and live like that? It's also got to be what the client is willing to do, because at the end of the day, it's up to them. You can't teach them. Their own bodies have to learn what they want, what they need to do. Does that make sense? Any questions, any thoughts?
I've got a bit of a thought.
Go on, Louise.
Sorry. So, it's the whole thing about getting them... Sorry, I've got feedback too. It's really annoying. Sorry.
It's okay, don't worry.
So, is it more about...
Oh, Louise, I have got feedback now. Oh.
Okay.
No.
Gosh. What happened? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I can hear you now.
Hello,
can you hear me? Oh, Louise, is there any way you can email, type, write me the answer? Your question, sorry. Try and do that for me. And I'll open up my email. Or text me, Louise. One or the other.
Is it work? Me chipping in here?
Yeah, yeah, go on, yeah.
Great to hear, because it really makes a lot of sense to me, actually, to get a parapet on this. It's felt quite awkward and quite over the exaggeration and all the other advice and paper over time. Working with it's almost felt more appropriate, perhaps more beneficial for them to their threshold of movement.
Yeah.
So almost, you know, how to progress separately rather than over recruiting.
Yeah.
So it kind of pulled me back into how to progress that, so you know, just strength and ability and things like that, and potentially have an input of explore from number and things like that. So it comes back into threshold progression again.
Yeah. And
rather than over recruiting, which this brings it back to our mainstream principles.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things to say about postnatal is the time when generally is... sorry, I'm just going to read what you've written there, Laura. Okay.
That's just what I said, so don't worry.
Yeah. No, because it was tricky to hear. So I'm just going to repeat it just for the recording. So so for you, Laura, it gives some clarity on this subject, which has felt awkward and stiff. Good over time. Working with postnatal clients, it feels more appropriate and more beneficial for them to focus on their threshold of movement and how to progress safely rather than over-recruiting pelvic floor. Good. My questions now are back to how best to progress clients' movement who have had an injured pelvic floor and how to progress beyond their threshold at the appropriate rate. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think what, in a way, I think we have to realise our limitations as Pilates instructors, in that, as I said to you, we don't have an ultrasound machine. We can't see if somebody is actually hypertonic or too loose. And as I've said, it's not necessarily whether it lifts up or drops down. It's the tension it creates at the time when it's necessary that we want to focus on. And so what I wanted to say, sorry, I was drifting off there, Laura, but what I wanted to say is that we generally become more aware of our pelvic floor if we haven't gone to Pilates classes that talk about the pelvic floor, is when we're pregnant. So what we don't know is if that woman is sat in a chair for years of her life and already has a pelvic floor which may not be functioning to its full potential because of the amount she sits, or the restriction in the thoracic area, and the diaphragm restriction, or over-recruitment, whatever. And then she goes through pregnancy and has issues. Is that due to deconditioning beforehand and it's just highlighted suddenly now? Or is it, it's very, very tricky. And also, you know, we haven't even talked about diastasis recti, which can obviously lead to that dysfunction in the pelvic floor as well. So I think one of the things I want to say is, what I hope I've really got across is voluntary contractions, functionally, it's not where we want to go. So therefore, what is so positive about Pilates is the ability to create this alignment and allow the body to learn what it needs to do. And one of the things that's really important, though, is gravity plays a huge role in this. Our relationship to gravity is really what we do all the time, okay? We have learnt over our years how to react and interact with gravity to do our everyday activities. So if I want to look at really encouraging a much better relationship between the pelvic floor, the diaphragm, and so on, I have to release things, I have to get the thoracic moving, I have to stand up. I have to use gravity to let my pelvic floor know what's going on. It's because lying on my back doing pelvic floor exercises is just so hard, okay? Because you don't have that gravitational relationship that helps me understand and helps my body learn, okay? Gravity is a huge key. So hence squatting is probably the best thing you can do for your pelvic floor, okay? Just to work with and against gravity. So I hope that makes sense. Sorry, Louise, I'm just reading what you said. So functional movements with the breath should help the person to improve their pelvic floor instead of focusing on over-recruiting it and holding it. Yes, perfect. Pilates is great. Even though I've sort of said, you know, about the standing up stuff, but there's so much we can do standing. There's so much we can do kneeling up. You know, what Pilates offers is the diversity of different positions against gravity. You know, we kneel up, we sit, we stand, we sideline, do you know what I mean? It's not just all on our backs. We use all these diverse planes and look at the alignment that we can create in those areas. So yes, I've gone way over time, flipping heck. Any other questions? I know we're getting lots of feedback and it's not very nice tonight, but is there any other questions that we want, or any other thoughts?
I'm just thinking, Joe, going forward with the NOs and stuff, men and pelvic floor is something that I'm quite interested in.
It's the same thing though, Mary. Do you know what I mean? It's exactly the same thing. And
but what I mean by that is...
Yeah. Yeah, it is so female focused, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
got a really stiff, immobile, etc. But even discussing pelvic floor, because they're mixed classes, whether a women as well, getting.
But do you need to discuss it, Mary? Do you need to discuss it? Because this is what we're saying. Why discuss it?
Well, it's not so much even.
No, Mary, I know exactly what you're saying. And this is it. This is where sometimes we talk about things with clients that they actually aren't really interested in. Some are, don't get me wrong, and you're like, great, let's get the pelvis out. Let's show.
Yeah.
But sometimes...
I'm thinking more generic stuff, because they will come and they'll want to leave sort of the or is it that I want them to leave with more knowledge? I don't know. It's further discussion. I've wanted
people's time now. No. Yeah, because I think that hopefully I've given you an awful lot to think about. And so don't worry if you can't collate your questions now, because I think, you know, I've sort of thrown you a lot of stuff to think of. And I think one of the things that's quite hard as Pilates instructors is sometimes we feel we have to give a lot of vocab. We have to give a lot of information. We have to cue everything. We have to, you know, sort of almost prove our knowledge, we can sometimes feel like. And we need to validate what we're doing. So often we feel we're doing shoulder bridge. I need to tell them why they're doing it and how they need to do it. Whereas actually, if we could say in just a few words what they need to do, their bodies will do it for them. And we should instead look at what's not quite right and think, how can I make this really simple? And that's why I've noticed, for me, my language when I teach has completely changed over the last 5 years. I've really stripped it back. I've really made it very everyday, I've tried to anyway, make it very simple. And that's what I'm getting the best results of. And yes, there are some people who love to know a bit more, and that's great. But a lot of people just need us to create an environment where the body learns how to move better. And I think that's what it is. So don't worry about not having your thoughts now, because for me, when I first started putting this together, I thought, my word, I hope you're going to have loads of thoughts for me, because this is really sort of turning on its head and questioning and making you consider the way you teach, the way you cue, and what we're saying and what we're looking for. So, yeah, so please don't feel you have to come in now. Just come back to me, and I can always do another evening, just almost recapping and reviewing and answering any questions, hopefully if we have better internet. So, Louise, you said, you know, people are so used to hearing the pelvic floor being cued that I feel people want to hear that they're using it. So what's the best thing to say to our clients about the pelvic floor? So you could, Louise, just say, if you're breathing well, your pelvic floor is working. It's almost exactly the same, Louise, as when, you know, suddenly we don't want to be saying the word core. You know, that we say, look, you know, if you've got lovely spinal movement, these areas are working, you know. So when they're doing their roll up and they're saying, oh, you know, do I need to pull up? You know, you're like, well, I can see the bones of your spine are moving beautifully. So you're doing it naturally. So I think trying to get across that natural, spontaneous, subconscious threshold is what we need to do. And, you know, and you could just say to them, because if they're moving well, if they're not wetting themselves, yeah, it's working for the activity they are doing. Yeah, so always think, if I'm doing a roll up and I'm not wetting myself, pelvic floor's working, if that makes sense. Anything else? Any other thoughts? I like your little ha ha ha. Or nothing's dropping out, the pelvic floor's working. So I'm thinking that you might not have any more questions, and we've gone way over time. So I do apologize if you had anything doing. What I'm going to do, and for those of you that are just getting the recording, I'm going to send you the picture of the hydraulic amplifier. Please be aware, though, it is a simplified one, because obviously with the hydraulic amplifier, we talk about thoracolumbar fascia and lots of other things go on with that, that I can talk about another time. I'm going to send you the pelvic floor image I have, because I think it's such a nice image that just makes it very clear what the pelvic floor is. I'm going to send you the link to the video, and I'm going to send you the link to the research paper that was published on the intravaginal IPA device and the Pilates exercises that you can read. As I say, unfortunately, I can't share with you the images that I got from the workshop because they're not mine to share. But I sort of hope that, you know, it gave you that you could see how the pelvic floor was moving with the ultrasound. And yeah, I want you to mull and think. And I really hope you've enjoyed tonight. Yeah, so have a wonderful weekend. Some of you I'm seeing at the Christmas party next weekend. And those of you I'm not, I'm going to raise a glass to you because you're just wonderful. And if I don't speak to you, have a lovely Christmas. Now it's December, we can say that. So well done, everybody.